let me deal with the stuff, right? So the stuff I'd been putting off that I thought wasn't a big deal ended up being cancer, but I really felt like not only accommodating different body sizes and shapes was important, but making people feel better about themselves. And I was so scared because I had no idea what I was doing because it was my first industry job. I just assumed everyone there knew a million times more than me, and I wanted to just learn absolutely everything that I could. That like following Monday, Nike offers me the job and Cotopaxi also offers me a job. Want, 'cause there's this idea with sports bras that like you just want to like hold everything down and then that's the best thing. But there's a point in movement reduction where once you go past that amount of movement reduction, it actually becomes more painful again. Like part of what I love about 3D especially is like reduction in environmental impact. So the reason I named it Rad Patterns was because I want it to be this radical act of self-love.
Hello, welcome to Underdressed, the podcast where we talk about the clothes under our clothes and exactly how they get made. My name is Trudy Gardner. I'm the freelance designer behind Wayfinder Lingerie. In this show, I'll be exploring the art, practice, and technical execution of intimate apparel. We'll be taking a behind-the-scenes look at this industry and trying to understand exactly how designers balance creativity with functionality, specifically as it pertains to our hardworking yet delicate base layers. Thanks for listening. I'll see you in the show. All right, Steph, welcome to the podcast. I'm super excited to have you here today.
I'm super excited to be here.
Nice.
Always fun to nerd out with somebody else.
Yeah, as before we started recording, we were just both like super nerdy about connecting with each other because we're talking about how we try to tell our husbands these things, and it's not the same as like when you actually connect with somebody else doing the same thing as you. So why don't you start off and introduce yourself to the audience and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Cool. So I'm Steph Thiel. I full-time freelance right now. I do pattern and fit are kind of my like, I would say like main key things that I do, but really anything in technical design and development. So everything that happens between like a design being created and the style going to production is sort of where I live. And I work on kind of a little bit of everything. That's one of the things I love about freelancing. I have a lot of my background has been in athletic activewear apparel, so I tend to get more of those projects just by like word of mouth connections. But I really do try to work on everything because I just love working on clothes. Like I'm so excited about any kind of clothes that that's sort of what I do. And then yeah, I also make home sewing patterns occasionally in my free time I don't have.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of like my little fun pet project, sort
So
of.
that's Rad Patterns, and I
Yep.
was telling you like when we first connected that I've used your the underwear pattern for kids for my son to make
Yep.
him underwear. So that's awesome.
Yeah, I love that you've used it. That's so cool.
Yeah. And you do a little bit of everything. Rad Patterns, I think it's like athletic focused, but a little bit of everything, right?
Yeah, it's so funny to see how it's changed over the years. When I first started Rad Patterns, I wasn't working in the industry, but when I started working at Adidas, we just kind of had an agreement that I wouldn't do anything athletic. Really, my boss was kind of like, these are not the same consumer, or if they are, they're not like buying a home sewing pattern and not buying a ready-to-wear product.
Yeah.
So she didn't really have a problem with it, but we
Oh,
kind of
that's
just,
cool. I love hearing
yeah.
like somebody from the industry that's open-minded, especially from a big
Right?
corporation.
Yeah, that was not always the case in my career. We could talk about that later.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I just kind of like didn't do athletic wear at that point just to kind of like avoid any potential appearance of like impropriety, anything like that. So I actually had like a lot of dresses. That's where all the when all the underwear patterns started coming out. So those are a lot of my older patterns. I did some costumes because I just like I like to have fun. I mean, that's probably like
Yeah, you can't tell. I don't know if you're
self-explanatory from
watching right
behind me.
now. Steph has blue hair and blue headphones, so
Yeah.
you wouldn't think she was a fun person.
Totally boring all the time. Yeah, and so as soon as I left Adidas though, I was like, well, now I don't have this restriction. So I went like hard on the athletic wear patterns. And yeah, it's just kind of like evolved over the years.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's actually really cool, like knowing that your background's with was with Adidas, like I have more respect for your athletic wear patterns now because I'm like, okay, you've got some pretty deep roots in the industry. So let's get into that. So Adidas, was that like your first job in the industry? Is that,
It was. So I started there. I'll give you my, I like to call this one of my two best interview stories. So, you know, when you're like in an interview and they're like, they want to hear about how you got where you got. And I'm like, cool, let me overshare everything. I'm really good at that. I graduated from design school with a two-year-old and very pregnant with my second child. I started grad school because I was like, oh, well, I made it through undergrad pregnant or with a baby the whole time. It'll be fine. And then 2 terms into grad school, 6 months pregnant, I was like, nope, this is not fine. And I dropped out of grad school. And we were like right after the whole economy had crashed. So there's no jobs. Everyone's been laid off.
Like 2008-ish.
Yeah, I graduated in the very beginning of 2011. So like January of 20 or December, I guess.
Technically. Okay.
Like I finished fall term. Okay. I was on like a weird schedule. Anyway, so 2010. So things... beginning basically end of 20 or 2009 and
oh this is super exciting because this is the beginning of like 3D design as well too, so I'm super interested to hear where this is going.
Well, the crazy thing is like I had almost two children and my husband graduated that year, so like I graduated a little bit before him, and as soon as he graduated we were living in family housing, so we're like, cool, we have to move now. No jobs anywhere. It was so great to be a graduate and go back to delivering pizzas, which is what I did before I went to college.
Thank God I got that college.
Do what you
got
to do, right? And so I ended up in like just like jobs to pay the bills, right? Like you do. And I worked, I worked a lot of retail, a lot of just like stuff I did not care about at all. And I ended up working, of all places, doing fraud investigations for a bank. I just like knew someone that was like, here, come work here. We train you. I was like, all right, great. It was actually kind of fun because you get to like dig around in people's backgrounds and it's like a little scavenger hunt. But I was working there and 6 months in, they were like, hey, so Oregon is really expensive to do business and our lease is up on this building and we're moving everything back to Virginia. So you can either come with or not. And they were actually, in terms of layoffs, really great. They gave us 5 months notice, which is like a lot.
That's huge. Yeah.
And I had been kind of like putting off some things because I'd only been there for 6 months and I was like, all right, I want to like move up. I don't know that I necessarily like let go of the apparel dream, but I was like, this is what I got to do right now. But if I'm not going to have a job anymore, let me deal with the stuff. Right. So the stuff I'd been putting off that I thought wasn't a big deal ended up being cancer, which I like didn't know. Obviously, I would have paid more attention to it. I like to consider being laid off like the best worst thing that's ever happened to me. And
it's always the case, right? Like that, right? Life always works out that way.
Yeah. And so I was so lucky. I had ovarian cancer, but at stage one, which is so rare to get diagnosed at that early of a stage with that. And so I was still technically working at this bank doing fraud investigations, but I took 6 weeks off to have surgery and recover and all that stuff. And I wasn't allowed to like really do anything out of bed for the first couple of weeks. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, how am I going to look at these two children as they grow up and tell them like, you can do anything you want to do when you grow up. I want you to care about what you do. I want you to follow what you're passionate about if I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
And so I started Rad Patterns then. We're broke. I put a $50 business license on a credit card. I had an 8-year-old laptop that I bought at the beginning of college that had a maybe or maybe not legitimate copy of Illustrator CS3 on it. And I was like, well, I know how to make patterns. I kept that skill up on paper, just making things for myself or my kids since graduating. And I was like, I can do this. And if I can't do it, and if it just fails spectacularly.
Nothing to lose. You got nothing to lose.
Yeah. Nothing to lose. And I can look at my kids and be like, I tried. Sometimes you don't make it. Sometimes you fail. That's okay. Totally. But you got to try.
Oh, how old are your kids now?
My daughter just turned 15 and my son is 12 and a half.
Oh, that's super interesting. Because my son's 7, and like after you have kids, it really shifts like the way that you look at your own life, right? Like, what matters to me? How am I going to teach them what matters to them if I haven't clearly identified what matters to
Right.
me? Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's where Rad got its start. And I was like, well, I learned Illustrator in school. I learned pattern making in school. I bought digital like
Okay, this is
PDF
super
download
interesting.
patterns.
So Rad Patterns. So this is still around 2000, like 2011-ish.
No, it had been a couple years, so 2015.
So like this is like when I feel like online sewing patterns really started taking hold. Like it's probably when I started sewing around 2015. And that's when it's like before, well, I was like working a lot and not really like pursuing sewing before that, but my son was born in 2015. That's when I started sewing for him. And that's before that, it wasn't really accessible or available, the type of knowledge, patterns especially. Like you could go to Fabricland and get, your, where are you, by the way, located?
So right now I live just north of Portland, Oregon, in Wash, like on the Washington side of the river, but that's recent. I started Rad just south of Portland, in a town
Okay.
called Tigard that no one's ever heard of.
Yeah.
but Oregon-ish.
So you guys, you don't have Fabricland, but you have I forget the equivalent. What's like your main fabric store?
I mean, we have like a Joann Fabric that's
Yeah, Joann's,
everywhere.
that's yeah, exactly.
They don't exist anymore, but like we used to have Hancock Fabrics. That was like
Yeah.
the better one, and like Fabric
Okay.
Depot, things like
Yeah,
that.
yeah. Yeah, so I was trying to get around to the point that if you wanted to learn sewing or acquire sewing patterns, you would have to go and buy those big four patterns. And the instructions were so bad in them that like if you didn't know already have like your grandma didn't teach you already how to sew, or you didn't go to design school or something, like you wouldn't you would make up these patterns and they would be horrible and you wouldn't know how to fix them. And around 2015, a lot of information that the whole home sewing community started to explode, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's like the timing of it was because I could see that happening. I started sewing here and there PDF patterns because, like you said, like there weren't a lot before that when my kids were babies. I cloth diapered them and there were a lot of like cloth diaper patterns available. So that was in like my daughter was born in 2008 and then my son was born right at the beginning of 2011. Yeah. And so like I bought those patterns for them, but like there weren't a ton. There were like some layette baby kind of patterns, diapers, and then a handful of others. And when I was getting around to starting Rad, I was kind of looking at what was out there. And a big thing that I noticed just selfishly for sewing for myself was like most people aren't doing plus size patterns. I'm plus size if you're not watching, but so like that made a lot of things inaccessible to me in terms of
Huge,
sewing for myself, unless
yeah.
I was going to take the time to grade it out, which I have that skill set because I went to design school, but at that point I may
But
as well
you
just
just
draft my
recognize
own.
that it's not, yeah, exactly. That's
Yeah.
that this is a gap in the market. And the crazy thing about it too is that like a lot of the times I heard this on Jenny Brushmore say this for Cashmere, like on a podcast I listened to a little while ago, but around this same time, I'm sure the state of the industry is might be slightly different today, but the average store wasn't carrying the average size of the woman in North America.
Yep.
And then,
Yeah.
so patterns were following that. The average pattern wasn't being drafted for the average size of the woman in North America. So, for sure, there's a huge, and I think there still is a huge, because like when you learn pattern drafting in school, they teach you how to make a size six based on some very basic measurements. Like, here's how you draft a size six, and here are the measurements for a size six. Like, they don't even teach you how to draft based on measurements.
Yeah. And the interesting thing too is like with like you were talking about before, those big four paper patterns. This has shifted in the last probably decade or so, but they used to be very different in terms of like what a size six means. And so a lot of people that home sew kind of know that like pattern sizing and ready-to-wear sizing are way different. But a lot of the indie PDF patterns were trying to at least close that gap. So even if they weren't offering plus sizes, their size six or 10 or 12 was at least more equivalent to if you went to the mall and bought a six or 10 or 12.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's because they were being made by women for women, which is like,
Exactly.
it wasn't being made by a big corporation saying, like, here's the information that we already have. Here's the standard information that we've collected over like from various places and various points of time.
Yep, exactly. And like, at least that kind of gap in the industry was being filled. But I went to start RAD because I had time and I wanted to try something. And I was like, well, I know that I struggle with finding patterns that include my size. Some brands do, some brands don't. And I also had noticed in like friends that were on the very thin side that the same thing was happening, right? Like they're having this gap here where you have a pattern that starts at an extra small, and maybe at a big four pattern that actually would fit them because those tend to run so much smaller. But in these indie patterns, an extra small is maybe a little bit too big. And so there's kind of not this consideration for all bodies in all sizes. And then different like body morphotypes, which is just kind of like, I think known colloquially as more like pear shape, apple shape, those kind of like dumb names that people put on body shapes. But like those different body proportion and morphotypes aren't really accounted for either. And so I launched RAD with this idea of starting really small, so a 2X small. I started out going to a 4X and I adjusted things that so it wasn't exactly ready to wear sizing. I'm sure people will want to call it vanity sizing because it definitely was like a 4X. If you were to go to like Elaine Bryant or a Torrid, you'd probably be like a 3X in my patterns if you wore a 4X there. But I really felt like not only accommodating different body sizes and shapes was important, but making people feel better about themselves. And like, I don't like to call that vanity sizing because I don't think it's vanity to like be accepting or like body neutral about yourself. I think that's really healthy. It's a thing I struggle with on my own a lot, but like I want it for other people so badly. So like that's how I launched RAD. And over time, we actually have expanded up to like a 6X. When I do like numeric size woven patterns, we go to a 40, like an 80-inch hip in women's. So like,
Yeah, I mean, who cares about vanity sizing, right? Like,
right?
who care? Like, it's like there it's just a way to identify the pattern you're gonna pick, right? Like it has
Exactly.
like who cares what the number is on the paper? There are some there Jaylee does like letter sizing, you're just like A B
Yeah.
C D. Like it doesn't
I
quite like
love that.
I'm trying to think of like other ways that I've seen it done. But yeah, it's nice to remove the number of your circumference from like a certain ideology about the way you feel about your body.
When especially because the numbers are so like arbitrary and they make no
Are
sense, right?
so
Like
arbitrary, yeah.
in menswear, and I try, excuse me, with RAD, like I try to not necessarily gender our patterns. I think that's important too. Like we have such a variety in the world, just as there's such a variety in like body shape and body size, there's such a variety in gender identity and like how people want to buy patterns. Like that's something I've been really working on the last couple of years to just not gender our patterns through RAD. And working on like going back and updating some of the ones from right at the beginning where I was gendering them because in my head I was thinking like, okay, but people need to know what body it's built for. But kind of like decoupling that is
So
something that I've
that's
really focused
interesting.
on.
I'd like to dive into that. How do
Yeah.
you remove gender from a pattern? Like what like 'cause patterns still are based on body shapes,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah,
So
no,
what's your approach to that?
that's such a good question. So I kind of for my adult stuff, because kids are separate, because you can do unisex kids, they don't really
Yeah,
start to
they're
be
just little
different from each
rectangles.
other
They're just
until
little
like,
rectangles. Yeah.
yeah, later. But for adults, I do have like three separate blocks that I've built and I draft off. And I think if you were working like in a traditional industry role, this would be a women's block, a men's block, and a unisex block. And the way that I kind of communicate that out, consumer facing, and the way I help people choose their size is one, a lot visually. So I have in my instructions like a little graphic that shows like a smaller end of the spectrum and bigger end of the spectrum size, but in that body shape. So it's just like a silhouette. And it just
Okay.
kind of talks you through like, hey, we don't want to assign a gender to you or make you choose what box you fit in, but when buying a pattern, but it's important to know if this pattern matches your body shape, is drafted for your body shape, or if there's some adjustments that you can make to make it fit better for you, which is true regardless of, you know, what gender somebody identifies as. And so it's a visual guide of like, this is the body shape that it's drafted for. I'll talk through like that it's for what would traditionally be known as our women's block. Like, it's a more hourglass silhouette, so there's a larger difference in like waist to chest and waist to hip ratio. This is the height that it's drafted for, etc. And then what would traditionally be the men's silhouette, kind of same thing. Like, this is the height that we're drafted for. It's got a broader shoulder, a smaller difference in waist to hip ratio. And so talking about what the difference is in body proportion and not necessarily assigning that to what gender that means.
Yeah, that makes sense. That was a good explanation.
Okay. but yeah, so that's kind of like where Rad is in terms of like sizing and how I like present that out consumer facing. But part of the reason is really just to make things feel accessible to people, because I don't want people to have barriers to like making clothes that make them feel good. Like, that's really been the goal of Rad since I started it.
Yeah. Like, there's this really good podcast. It's by Love to Sew with, I forget the host, Helen and Caroline. I don't know if you ever, kind of, it's such a good podcast, but they have one episode called Sewing Makes You Love Yourself.
Yeah.
And it's so good. And it's just, it's all about that. Like, you realize that you're not like, when you can take control over the way your clothes fit and the way you want them to fit and the types of clothes that you want to wear, because you can pick whatever pattern you want and pick whatever fabrics you want, and you're not subject to whatever's available just in the stores. It just gives you so much more just acceptance of what you have and what you have to work with.
Yeah, totally. I'm definitely going to check that podcast out.
Yeah, I'll link it so in the show notes for this one.
Awesome.
Okay, so I wrote down design school. Where did you say where you went?
I didn't. I went to Oregon State. Yeah, they have a great design program. It's a lot bigger now than it was when I went. When I went, I was the very last year that they did this, but they only started it once a year. So if you didn't get in that year, you had to wait. Now they do it every term admission. Because when I started there was like kind of around the time that like Project Runway was becoming like a big thing. People were talking about it. More people were applying into design schools. So the program was able to expand a lot. But that's where I went. I really actually appreciate that I ended up going to a state school, like a bigger university versus just like a design college. And I say that as someone who teaches at like a design specific like trade school. But the nice thing about Oregon State is it's a Bachelor of Science. So instead of being a Bachelor of Arts, you have a lot more focus on sort of the business side of things, sciences, body, that kind of thing, which is something
that's
that,
interesting. Yeah, we never talked about that. I did a 2-year diploma course, but I mean, we never talked about like bodies at all, or the like very little bit about the business side of it.
Yeah. And like, that's one of the things I didn't realize at the time. Like, I went there because it was an in-state school and it had the program I wanted. Like, that was really all of the decision-making that went into that.
Yeah. I feel like that's okay. Yeah.
Right?
I feel like no matter what you choose for school, like it's, you really learn after school. I feel like a lot of learning happens like once you start working.
Yeah. Definitely agreed. I've learned tons and tons more in my career than I did in school. But yeah, it's something I've come to appreciate a lot after the fact, like things like the science class, like textile science classes that I probably wouldn't have had in like a 2-year program. And if I had had the money to afford the 2-year program that was local to me, that's what I would have chosen. I was just too broke. So I went to the state school.
That's cool. Yeah. See, it works out. All right, let's come back around to so you liked your schooling, you appreciated having got what you got, and it sounds like you got a little bit more than what you expected. So
yeah, definitely.
That's awesome. I always like to talk about schooling because I think probably a lot of people out there are contemplating, and just I feel like the future of education is, who knows what's going to happen. Like we both just said, well, I'm sure it'll stay the same, but we both just said we learned more working than in school, and just with the access to information that's available now, and people, just so many people willing to share their knowledge. Like there's, it's just so much easier to learn the things that you want to learn just through like independent study.
Totally. Yeah, the amount of things that exist just on YouTube alone, like free education of everything. I am big into watching anything that I can watch that's going to teach me something new about
Me
apparel.
too. Me too. I love educational content on YouTube. I just love it. And just like, and the people doing it are doing it because they love it and they want to share it. So it's just like such a fun experience.
Totally.
Okay. I was circling back around to Adidas because this is what I want to hear about. This is like what really intrigued me about you because, but not just because that you worked for Adidas, but you worked for Adidas while they were developing their 3D programs. So let's dive into that.
Yeah, let's talk about it. So I started out at Adidas as a pattern maker for training apparel. So that's like anything you wear in the gym while you're working out or to and from the gym.
How did you get your job at Adidas?
So that same time that I was starting Rad and I was like, cool, I'm about to lose my job. I kind of did a little Hail Mary, let me see what happens situation. The situation that was happening that I was losing my job made me eligible for this program through the state that I could go back to school to an approved program for free. They would pay for it and they would pay me essentially like a salary instead of unemployment for the term of that if they approved it. And so I signed up for that program. I was going to go back and get my master's in teaching so that I could go and teach because that's something that I really enjoy. And that program wasn't going to start until like April of the following year. And I'm like, all right, cool. Between now and then, I'm going to apply for everything I can apply for in the industry. See who's even willing to talk to me. I got maybe a handful of first phone screen interviews, even. Most people were like, you have no experience. You graduated almost 5 years ago. That's forever in the apparel industry. But I get a call back on this job for a pattern maker at Adidas. And I go through the whole interview process and I get down to like the last three people where they bring you in, they do a pattern test so that it's not just like your interviews. Yes, you had good answers, but like, can you technically do the job well? And so I went in and I did that. And it was the longest hiring process I had ever been involved in. Like, industry hiring processes are long
That's
anyway.
stressful, like doing pattern drafting in a
So
like test format,
stressful.
like in front of other people.
Yeah, it was like, and then I finished the pattern really fast, I guess. I didn't feel fast to me, but like
Yeah.
my
What was the
interview.
pattern? Or what was the test? Do you remember?
So they gave you like a little half scale block, or I don't even think it was a block. I think it was like an already a style pattern. And then they gave you just like a tech pack photo of a different style and said, turn this into this,
Oh my
basically.
God, and you had to do it by hand.
And you had to do it by hand and
Oh
then write down all of your steps as you
my
went.
God.
And like,
And
so
you had to
like,
do it there? Like you can't they should like let you go home and like that's like a afternoon like sip on your tea and work on this
Well,
pattern type of thing.
and like the crazy thing is like it was they gave you 2 hours. So like she brings me to like their sample studio. I've got all the tools and everything. Like they gave me everything I needed, but it was like, here, this is the project. Like, here's my number. Text me if you're done or if you have a question about something. Like, I'm gonna go back to doing my job kind of thing. And I get done apparently really fast. It didn't feel fast to me.
Yeah.
And
No,
I
that's
text her
intense.
and she like comes back and she's like, oh, like you're done. It wasn't a question. Like, she was expecting that I was texting her because I had a question. She was like, that
Because you
was
had a
so
question.
fast, which then made me so nervous. I was like, I must have fucked this up bad. That like this like insanely talented pattern making manager is telling me that that was super fast. I'm like, I'm screwed. They're not hiring me. And at this point, my interview process from the beginning had been months long because the pattern manager, like pattern makers in specific departments, don't report into the pattern manager. They report into like that department's director. So my hiring manager, that would be my boss, needed to be involved in the hiring process, but the pattern manager also needed to be because, like, even though they're not your boss, they'd still, you need both of them to approve. And they kept, like, kind of oppositely ending up needing to be in Germany for stuff. So we just, like, kept having this, like, everything's taking so long between steps. And I get to the end of the pattern test and I'm like, sure that I fucked it up. I leave. Like, they're not going to call me back. And it's all the way to when school is starting. And I'd kind of given myself this time limit of if school starts, then that's what I'm doing with my life. I go to 1 week of classes. And they call me and they offer me the job. And I'm like,
oh my God.
Oh my God. Okay. Yes, absolutely. And then I drop out of grad school for the second time. but that's kind of how I started there. It was my first industry job and I had the pattern making skills. All of the retail that I hated working actually is really in the end what helped me land the job, because I was coming into a team whose previous pattern maker had kind of, one, left a while ago, so there'd been a gap, things were messy, and two, I guess the relationships had like not been great between that pattern maker and some of the team, and so they were wanting somebody to come in and those like people management skills from being like a retail manager to just be able to, like, I don't know, listen to people in diffuse situations was like, really, I think, you know, if either of the other two people that they brought in for that pattern test, I'm sure they were also capable pattern makers, but that was kind of like the skill set that brought me in. And so I came into this team and I was so scared because I had no idea what I was doing because it was my first industry job. I just assumed everyone there knew a million times more than me. And I wanted to just learn absolutely everything that I could. So they taught me Gerber because we'd learned OptiText in school, but Adidas uses Gerber. So I learned that like my first week there. And now I kind of am spoiled by it. It's my favorite pattern program. And every time
you
I
still
try to
use Gerber, right?
I still use Gerber. Every time I try to
when you were draft else, when you were drafting for Rad, were you doing it? You were
in
doing
Illustrator.
All in Illustrator. Okay.
In Illustrator, I was just like, well, I know how to do it on paper. I can translate what that is in using like the line
just
and
lines. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
But oh my gosh, it took so long. So going into Adidas and learning on Gerber, I would spend not just making the pattern, but grading a pattern in Illustrator. I would spend
grading a pattern
on something
is crazy.
That would take me 2 hours.
Like, yeah, because Illustrator like is not made for pattern drafting. Mm-mm. Like to move a point, like I want to move this point a quarter inch that way. Like it's not simple, right? Like it's
you have to like click the point, click the quick keys for move, type in your numbers, and like,
yeah, exactly, to say, but then your pattern has to be at the right angle as well, right? Like, yep. You have to make sure it's like rotated to be like moved,
exactly.
So that point moves in the right direction that you want it to move in. Yeah,
it was a lot. I don't recommend it, but no, I was starting with nothing, so
it's
I
something.
Yeah,
that's exactly that's exactly what I did too, because I wanted to learn pattern drafting. I wanted to learn digital pattern drafting after I finished school. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do an Illustrator. And I was like, there's got to be a better way. Like immediately I was like, there's got to be, like, what other programs are there?
Yeah. I definitely don't recommend it to anybody, but sometimes you're
so definitely very lucky to learn Gerber then. Cause it's still, what do you think? Like it's from my perspective, it seems to be still the industry standard, maybe OptiText and Lectra.
Yeah, it's definitely still, I would say those three are kind of the top three, and Gerber especially. A lot of the like kind of really random one-off projects that I get here and there are literally people that are like, my factory will only work in Gerber. I just need this converted. Mm. And like, I'll convert their pattern from DXF or from, if they've done it and they have a PDF because they were working with somebody else and they didn't get their like source files. Like people need that. Mm. I think that it will start to change as more programs are more accessible, but I don't know. And Gerber's cost keeps going up. Like my license, I have their subscription where it's like an annual fee versus like buying the license outright. And the price from 2 years ago to when my contract, like I signed 3 year contracts at a time. And so when my contract is up next, my price is going to double from what it was. And like, that's such a huge jump.
Yeah.
And
so like, you can tell me, you don't have to share your prices if you're not comfortable with it. But when I was looking it up, it was like $20,000 a year for Gerber. Is that like in the ballpark?
It depends on which. So they have lots of different, like, what you can buy, what you can't buy. So PDS is their pattern design software. You need that is like your basic. You can't function without that and make patterns. And then they also have marker making, which is like an additional add-on and separate cost. And then they have like digitizing, which again is like an additional add-on and separate cost. And then there's some other things as well. Like they have a 3D program. I've never used it. I don't know if it's good or not. No one I know has used it.
No,
so
I know.
but like all of those add up. So for just pattern making and like being able to make patterns, grade patterns, and create markers, that's about $5,000 a year.
Okay, so I'm way off.
And like, but
but
you
it depends on
probably,
like if it was like the other.
Yeah. And like the digitizing adds more, other programs add more. And they also will sell you just like the license, like permanent license versus annual.
Oh,
and
okay.
that is probably where that price came from.
Okay,
because that
maybe.
starts,
yeah.
I want to say that that starts at like $12,000 or something for like just okay. pattern software and goes up to like $20,000 or $30,000.
Okay, okay.
And so then you have it and you're not paying for it again.
Yeah. I'm glad I talked to you because
really
this number's been in my head. And like, this is like the number that I spit out when I talk about Gerber because I don't really know. It's like, it's just like there in my head. So I'm glad you finally clarified that for me. Thank you, Steph.
No problem. Yeah, it's a lot, especially when you
compare
it to
a
things
lot.
Like
yeah.
Clo.
Like Clo, which is $500 a year. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's totally different. And so I was really lucky to learn it. A little bit spoiled now that I'm like, well, that's the one that I need because I'm fast at it.
But
I
it's
know
also
you
the standard. Like if you are a pattern, if you're like, I feel like it gives you a lot of credibility as a pattern maker to be like, my pattern's coming Gerber. You can really communicate well with other, with factories and other vendors because everybody seems to be using Gerber.
Yeah, definitely.
But it also, but what's really cool is that like that also works with Clo and Browseware, right? Because you can transfer your DXF patterns.
Yeah, which let's talk about 3D. So about not very long into me starting at Adidas, 6 months at most, maybe even less. I don't remember because it's been a while. But Adidas was like, we're going to hop on this digital train and learn 3D. And so they weren't sure which way they wanted to go, Clo or Browseware. And I know because I honestly, 3/4 of the people that I worked with at Adidas are at Nike now. Adidas and Nike both kind of did that same thing. We're going to buy both and make a decision later once we've had a chance to like really use them. So at Adidas, they brought in the trainers from both Clo and Browseware for our pattern team. And we had like a week long or something. Like I think one of them was like 3 days and one of them was like 4 days or something like that where the trainers
so
were
you
there
learned both
in a room. We learned
like
both.
You, it wasn't like this group of people is learning this and this group of people. They trained everybody on both.
Yeah.
What a
so
cool
at least,
opportunity.
Right? Yeah. It was so great. And that was, so our pattern team is who learned both. And then they were trying to get some of the other teams like design to learn both. And some people were super receptive to that. One of the designers that I worked with, like he's so great. And he now works doing like 3D stuff specifically, not for Adidas anymore elsewhere. But like he was quick into adopting it and like picked it up really great. And like, it was such a great tool for him and like so efficient. He was already a really good designer. I'm sure that that helped too, but we learned both. And the interesting thing is at the time when we learned it, Clo, because Clo is built off of like video gaming software, right? So it has a great user interface. It's a lot easier to learn than Browseware, or at least than Browseware was that many years ago. But its accuracy at the time, not great. Neck bands were the one thing we would just constantly comment about because we were learning not only what they were training us with, but they also had us bring some like production ready fit approved pattern to sew those up and start to see what does that look like in Clo versus what does it look like on our dress form that's in the room. And most things looked really good. The neck band had what we dubbed bacon wave. So it's just like wavy around the whole neck band. And you're like looking at it on the mannequin in real life, totally fine. Lays perfectly flat.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, that's a really common thing. We haven't really worked out that bug, like how to fix it yet. But you just apply elastic to that top edge to make it lay flat. So you're like cheating the system. You're not really using it for a fit tool.
And then like, I feel like when you start, like you're either in one camp or the other. Like you're either like, okay, you got to cheat and make it work. And we're going to work around that. Or you're like, no, that's super inaccurate. This program sucks. And we got to go back to like the old school way of doing things.
And then we learned Browseware at the same time. And Browseware is trickier, or at the time anyway, was trickier to learn, a little bit more just like cumbersome in how you sew things together, how you just like arrange things. I don't know. It was just more challenging to learn initially, not as good of a user interface, but the accuracy when you're looking at your real pattern or your real sample physical right next to you and what's on the screen so much closer.
Okay. And that was, and this was like all the way from the beginning, even at the beginning, Browser was pretty accurate. Okay.
Yeah. And there were definitely still like little things where they were like, hey, you know, this is gonna, like, certain things would look like more wrinkly in 3D than they would look in real life. And I think that's still true of both programs. But it was just like, from a technical accuracy standpoint, they were miles apart way back then, like 8, 9 years ago. And our whole pattern team is like team browseware at this point, right? We learn them both and we're like, no, no, we don't want to use that one.
Oh, it's so good to get this perspective, because I've been like, I ask everybody, like everybody who does like Clo or browseware, why do you pick one or the other? And a lot of people land on the same conclusion. A lot of pattern makers like browseware and a lot of creative designers like Clo better. And it's cool to hear that in the beginning, it's because browseware was so much more accurate. And that makes sense.
Yeah. And like when our designers started learning it, if they were willing to learn both, they pretty much exclusively gravitated to Clo. Easier user interface. They're trying to change something visually. They want to be able to see and do things in that visual way. And everyone in design was definitely a team Clo. And us on the pattern team, which like just from a numbers perspective, at that point, there were 5 pattern makers in Portland, including myself, for all of Portland Adidas, and like probably 100+ designers. So like, it wasn't like, there were a lot of opinions.
Wasn't an even balance.
Yeah. But they were like,
How did you feel about working in browseware compared to working in Gerber?
So at the time they weren't really comparable, because we were still doing 100% of our pattern work in Gerber, and then Clo and browseware were both more of a fit check or a tool to help communicate between design and tech or design and development.
Yeah. So it would be just like, send the patterns to the 3D program, sew them up. But if you need to make any changes, they go back to Gerber to make pattern changes.
And we would make small changes sometimes directly in one of the programs. But if it was like a bigger change, I think it came down to efficiency. All of us had been efficient in Gerber at that point. Like, it was faster. And the pattern changing abilities in both programs was so different then. Like, it was a lot more tricky, a lot more finicky. But Adidas, and I'm sure Nike did the same thing, Adidas was very upfront with Clo and browseware that they were buying both, and they were going to give feedback, and they were eventually going to make a decision. And we had so many licenses, like I have no idea what they paid for it, but it was a lot. Clo was so much quicker about taking that feedback and updating and iterating.
Oh, interesting.
And really listening.
That is so this is so interesting, because I recorded a podcast last week with Leisha Sanders, who worked at Browser, like right at the beginning, like as they were starting things out. And her perspective was like, she was a designer. She came from the design world. And so that she, and like while she was learning, was giving feedback to the programmers about like how it needs to be changed for design. And Sophia was on the call with me, and we were like, well, we know Clo takes feedback now, but we don't know what it was like in the beginning. So this fills in a hole in that conversation.
And they were so good about it. And the thing is, like, it wasn't that browseware was bad about taking the feedback, because they also listened. I think because browseware was so much more technically accurate already, it was a lot more effort for them and it took a lot more time for them to make accurate updates, because they didn't want to lose any of that accuracy while accommodating the things that people were asking for. And that makes total sense to me as like somebody looking at the situation and being like, yeah, I get why they took a long time. They wanted it to be done well, which isn't to say that Clo didn't want it to be done well, but you're working off two completely different platforms, two completely different starting points, and Clo being built off video game software. I think it was just like a lot more adaptable code to begin with. It made it a lot easier.
That makes sense. Because it would be, because they probably just found it on like the programmers, where browseware was founded on half, I don't know the stats, but that it's coming from like programming versus it's coming from like the designer sphere of things first. So that's a cool perspective. What was I going to say about that? The adaptation. Yeah. So that Clo does even still a really good job. Like I do, I try to like sign up for their online classes whenever they have them, and they will always take down notes. Like, okay, we're gonna pass that along. You know what I mean? They're always taking down notes. We'll pass it along to the programmers. So I definitely see it just in the culture. It's like built into the culture of Clo. And I think they're probably more okay with making mistakes because every time they come out with an update, it like breaks the program, and you just have to
You're like, you
like
have the new
deal with
update
it.
2 days later.
Yeah, exactly. You have to deal with it. The patches come in. They just accept that's part of the growth, probably.
Yeah, and it's been so interesting too to watch because I think on the outside of that, like sitting at Adidas and watching it look like Klo's listening to our feedback, they're making changes really fast, Browseware isn't. That's like the impression that a lot of people got from the situation. So the people that were already like, Klo is better anyway, it really pushed them that direction a lot more. And I would say probably 2 years in at most, we started to heavily go in like, Klo is the direction we're going in as a brand kind of way. And they still kept the Browseware licenses, which we liked on the tech team because they were so much more accurate for us. Things like now, I know obviously that you use 3D all the time in Klo, but for anyone listening that maybe doesn't, in Klo, there's different simulation types, right? You can do like the fast simulation to just like really quick. So you have the like standard one and then the fit accurate one. That fit accurate one did not exist before, wasn't there. You had
Okay,
one simulation option and that was it.
That's interesting because I say this all the time. If you want to cheat in Clo, it's very easy. But if you want to get more accurate, you can. Like, you could set up your program to see more detail as well.
Yep, and now you can, but you couldn't back then. It
Okay.
was just
Just the basic.
the
It's like,
basics.
you got what you got. Yeah.
Yeah, and
Which
like they
allows you to
both,
cheat. Like, it doesn't show you the wrinkles. It
right.
doesn't show you if, like, a seam line is not trued up properly or.
Exactly. And like the goal at the time at Adidas was that eventually for simpler styles, we would be able to have like an end-to-end process where the block is already sewn up in Klo or Browseware if they'd gone that direction, but they went Klo. Like the block is already sewn up and design can go in and do things like add a cut line, put graphics, like graphic tees, use 3D a lot, that sort of thing. And then generate that into the tech pack and send it on because the starting block is correct. Whereas like a more complex design, we might use Klo as like the pattern maker to check something, or design might use Klo initially to like kind of get their ideas out and communicate them, but we wouldn't necessarily use their Klo pattern because it's probably not true. It's probably just like they got it to look the way they wanted, and then we're taking as the pattern maker like that visual, the same way you would take like a technical flat sketch and making like a correct pattern
Right.
version of it. But we, like I said, we kept the Browseware license. When we started developing plus size blocks at Adidas, we actually had our 3D mannequins in Browseware from Alvinon
Oh,
because,
Alvinon. Okay, I was gonna
yeah.
ask. So the blocks came from Al your avatars came from Alvinon.
Our avatars came from Alvinon.
So I
All
didn't
the
even know Alvinon's been around for a while too, then with their digital products. Okay.
And I don't actually know if I'm allowed to say this or not, but I am. Alvinon's, like all the body data that we were using, was coming from them. And then we were building the blocks ourselves. So it was
Okay.
myself and a couple of other pattern makers were like the project team for building those blocks because they hadn't done plus size at all before at that point. And now there's like the Alvinon body platform, and you can sign up and get, you know, the avatars in multiple programs. But at the time, it was like those digital avatars were really only available to bigger brands and they were expensive. And so we had to pick one. And since it was the pattern team that was making the decisions on that, we were like, Browseware, that's what we want. So we used it for that because getting custom mannequins from Alvinon, like it takes so long for them to come. So we wanted to be able to get started on our project, get blocks built, do trial runs in 3D, get some of the major glaring things taken care of in 3D. And then we were sewing in-house samples after that, fitting them on fit models, and then eventually also having our dress forms. But that took months. So we really used both. And I like so lucky to have learned both.
Yes, you are. It's really
Right.
incredible, especially at that time, just watching things. What was I going to say? So half the, well, not half the pattern makers were using Browseware and the Alvinon avatars, and then the Clo side, were they using the Clo avatars?
So initially they were using the Clo avatars. We had a 3D team at Adidas that were like 3D people. They weren't designers, they weren't technical designers, they weren't apparel background people. They were coding people. They were programmers. They were like that
they
tech
were
side
they
of it.
did they used Blender and Maya,
Exactly.
right? Like the
Exactly.
3D, like actual.
And then so they actually built in Clo, or I don't know how they built them, but they built versions of our Adidas standard size avatars
okay.
to then be used in Clo. And so they weren't technically the Alvinon ones, but they were based on our Alvinon forms,
Sure,
and
they were probably like
they were
exactly the same.
basically the same.
Yeah.
So that's what we were using. We just had like a
Okay,
shared file
so they
storage.
were okay.
Yeah.
And then okay, so I'm interested in knowing about the approval of these designs. So walk me through your process a little bit as a pattern maker. Were you getting tech packs and sketches from design to turn into patterns?
Yeah, so the process, whether or not we were using 3D, would be our handover from design to development would be what internally we called tech packs. I think a lot of other places call it like a design pack, but it's your Illustrator file that has the technical flat sketches. Maybe some of the stitching is called out, and design and development would have like a sit down. We'd go over all the details. If something was unclear, we'd like talk through like what construction are we doing here? And then on the pattern side, we would take that, and it kind of had two paths. If it were a more simple style compared to the blocks, because Adidas has like an extensive block library, then the factory would pattern it. And so our job on the pattern side would just to be give them the right information. Start with this block, make XYZ changes, and then we'd send that on. And then if it were more complex style that we didn't feel like we could just have the factory do that, then I would start sometimes with a block or sometimes with a just drafting from zero, depending on what the style was, and take that sketch and create the pattern. And then on the 3D side, in the beginning, it was more use this if you want to use it. Eventually, we're going to try and streamline some processes for the simpler styles, but those simpler styles.
What a nice way to like start
right?
with, because I think a lot of people are like, want to bring like a smaller brands, especially want to bring on 3D, but they're expecting 3D to be this big answer that it's just not ready to be yet.
Definitely. And the interesting thing too, is that like, even just a couple, it's been probably 2 years since the last time I like really had a touch point with what is happening internally at Adidas with pattern, because I contracted for them after I left. But even at that point 2 years ago, like 3D was being used for those simpler styles, where as a pattern maker, I wasn't really touching them anyway. I was spending, you know, 15 minutes maybe getting the right information in the PLM system to tell the factory what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like I was doing pattern making for that anyway. And those are the types of styles that are being done in 3D now, where they're able to bypass that little bit of time for the pattern maker, which is great, because that was always like a, you'd turn on some music and just like pound through it because it was really boring.
Yeah.
So it's nice to like take that task off, but they're using that like 3D in an end-to-end way on those simpler styles now, where design is able to say like, this is the block. They have an understanding of which block they want to pull from the 3D library.
Okay.
And then what changes they're making to it. And they're sending that onto the factory. There's a whole process written for the factory to follow,
okay.
Whether that's using the pattern as is, but that the factory is checking for things like it being trued correctly, etc. So like that's kind of their process, or was their process a couple years ago. And then on the more complex styles, we were using it still as a pattern team as a check before sending it out for a first sample. So I would sew something up in 3D, see if there was anything glaring that like I saw that was like, this isn't working. Sometimes it was a good way to like communicate with the team. If there was a style that you really felt like this isn't going to execute well, sometimes you have to like prove it before, right? And I get that, right? If you're really passionate about this thing that you've designed and you want it to work so badly, you want to just try it. So I get that, but it's like a good way to kind of cut out that
Yeah, totally. That's
physical.
exactly what 3D is for. That's exactly what it's for. Like, here's my this. I have this idea in my head. Is it gonna work? And then you're like, ooh, it doesn't really work, right? Like, and
So
you
like
can cut it out there. Yeah.
exactly. Or like another big way that we used it when I was still there as an internal employee, and again we used it when I was there contracting, was like for color ups. So we had one, I'm not going to say the name of the account because I don't know if I'm allowed to, but like there's one account that basically they're on a really short calendar and they buy into the normal line. And then they say, okay, here's the gaps that we're missing. We want you to create these pieces for us exclusively. And then they do that. So there's a team that builds that product. And so it's sort of like SMS product or like quick turn product, but it's specific to that account. So with them, color ups were a big deal. And in the past, they've just been doing it as like CADs, like flat sketches with the different colors, but being able to show them in 3D or like live in the meetings. Like I would help beforehand build things for the designer, and then the designer would be the one in the meetings with the account and could change the color really
Right, like
instantly
that. Yeah, it's so
and be able
quick.
to
Like,
talk through
click,
it.
click this color. So let's I just want to dig into color a little bit. I find that, like, I don't know, like there's I struggle with getting color accuracy because of the lighting in 3D, because you can change it just like in real life. If you have different lighting, you're going to get a different color. Like, even if you're selecting the right Pantone color, even if you're selecting the right Pantone color and you're using the same lighting across all of it, like, I just find it hard to get consistency with lighting. Was that ever a complaint?
Not really, but the reason for that is because a lot of the time I feel like the color issues that I've seen pop up in Clo, part of it's the lighting and part of it's like whatever the fabric properties are.
That'll affect it as well. Yeah.
And we would cheat the system a little bit for that. So we would build it, get all the fit and everything with the correct fabrics. And like their main 3D view would have all the correct fabric textures, everything like that. But the color ups, we would remove all the textures.
Oh, okay.
And so then when you're flipping through the colors, it's pretty accurate
Oh, that's
because
interesting. Good
it's
tip.
not,
I'm gonna try that.
and I think too, at least with that account in particular, they usually had physical swatches in front of them of all the different colors. And so it was more about like, they did a lot of color blocking with that account. So it was more about like moving where the different color blocks were
Sure.
happening. And I
Right.
think they
Yeah.
had
And I
that like
mean, it must have
physical
been so
sample.
amazing to be like in the meeting and be like, actually, can you swap those two? And you could just do it like instantly. Yeah.
So it was, I think that's one of my favorite things we used it for.
Yeah, that's really cool. Okay, so you're the pattern drafter, and so at the beginning, in some cases, they were looking at the 3D model to make decisions, but not always at the beginning. But now it's more settled into that process, you think?
I think it in some teams, yes, and in some teams they're really not using it
Mm.
at all. It just kind of really depends on like what that buy-in looks like. I know the teams that are more straightforward, things like graphics, where it's graphic tees, it's sweats with a graphic on it, like that sort of thing, they are very well integrated into like that 3D process end to end. And some of the other teams, like when I left there, I had worked on the first Ivy Park drop when I was an internal employee, right when they signed Beyonce, and then I left. And I came back as a contractor for that product,
Cool.
specifically, which was like a lot of fun, but also a lot of chaos.
Yeah.
And so that team was a little bit different in like how we were utilizing 3D or trying to utilize 3D just to like cut down on sample rounds and like review
Yeah.
things.
Did you
But
ever get to meet Beyonce? I have to
did.
ask.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, cool. That's cool.
We did fittings sometimes at her like offices basically. And so she would be there. She was super involved. I'm like, I don't know how
Oh,
much of this I'm
cool.
allowed to say, but she was really nice. I worked with her. Like we did fittings for 2 straight days and she was there. She was involved the whole
Cool.
time. She's
Oh, that's
super, super
amazing.
nice. Yeah.
Yeah, right on.
So it was fun.
Cool. Nice sidetrack story.
But it was, like trying to utilize 3D on that kind of team was a lot different because we would just use it like internally, but our 3D wasn't necessarily going outside of the Adidas team.
Okay. Yeah.
And it wasn't like
it, it's harder to, I find it's easier to work within your team because your team kind of just accepts and knows like what, where the workarounds are and like how far you can push it. And I feel like there's a lot more pressure when you want to present that to like an external agency now. Like you want it to be as perfect as possible. So let's get back around to that. So so we got to sometimes you're using for fittings. So would that 3D file continue to be modified throughout the fitting process? I imagine there wouldn't be too much work, like fitting rounds at Adidas, but if there were,
not usually. Once we got into physical sampling with the factory, we really weren't using the 3D anymore at that point, unless it was maybe for like a print scale or something like that. Just because at that point, one, you're doing things rapidly and you're usually doing a lot of styles at once.
Yeah.
And so our typically for fit rounds, like we would have our fittings and we would only have a couple of weeks to get all of our comments, all of our updates, all of everything back to the factory. There really just wasn't time.
And it's probably like hundreds of styles, right?
Yeah. It was a lot. So yeah,
right on.
It was,
Cool. Okay. So that kind of brings us around to where you're at today. So you're freelancing now. You're mainly doing pattern making. We talked a little bit at the beginning of this podcast. Do you do from creative design all the way to, do you go through the fitting process as well?
I do. Yeah. So okay. It depends on the client and like kind of what their needs are. I have some clients where I do literally end to end everything. And those are usually really small brands. So one in particular I've been working with for several years now, and we meet at the beginning at product brief. We go over like, here are the brief styles. Here's the list. I come back to them with initial designs. We do design review. And then I take it, I build out tech packs from there. I do all of the development and communication with the factory. The samples get shipped to me. I fit them. I comment back, et cetera, all the way until we're ready for bulk production. And then then I'm done. But
you're like, then it goes like, out okay, into the world.
exactly. And then I have other brands. These are usually like the more mid-sized brands that have a bigger team, like a more robust team in-house already, where maybe they have a designer internally, but they don't have a pattern maker. So it's on those teams, I'm acting a lot more similarly to how I worked at Adidas, where like they're coming to me with sketches ready. And I'm just creating the pattern, often doing a 3D version of it that we'll review together, make sure there's not any changes, maybe updating the 3D if there are changes, and then sending out for physical samples. Those kind of vary from brand to brand, whether that's kind of it for me and they manage the rest of fit and development. So with some brands, I manage the fit rounds, and some brands that, again, like if they have a bigger internal team, they just don't maybe have enough product, or they're not big enough to really have a full-time pattern maker, then their developer will usually take over the fitting and stuff at those brands. But others, I do like the management of that.
Awesome. This is cool to hear. I'm interested, intrigued by your transition to a freelance career. Can you tell us a little bit about how you made that transition and how you find clients and how you manage your schedule like with all these different clients?
This is now currently my very recent second foray into full-time freelancing, but the first time the universe just shoved me off a cliff. That's how I do most things in life. I kind of got to the point with Adidas where I had gotten everything I think I was going to get out of the job, and it started to become a really like unhealthy environment. The team that I was on in particular, some of the people were amazing. Most of the people were amazing. And those same amazing people were also finding it really toxic, and like just everybody was not having a good time. And so I had freelanced a little bit on the side, and I had like maybe this pipe dream of like, oh, maybe I'll freelance full time one day, but I was not ready to make that jump. It was terrifying. So I was applying for jobs, and I actually got hired at the North Face, and that was pre-pandemic. This was in 2019. They hired
They're
me.
Doing some pretty cool stuff in 3D as well. The North Face is doing pretty cool work in 3D.
Yeah, and they were, at the time that I was interviewing, that's definitely something that we talked a lot about. And so we would have had to relocate to Denver. They offered me the job in December of 2019. And I was like, cool. If I work one day in January, I get my bonus at Adidas. So are you cool if I wait until January 2nd to put my notice in? And they're like, yeah, that's fine.
Nice.
So I know that I'm leaving for like 2 or 3 weeks before I actually put my notice in. And I'm just like counting down the days. I'm so done with everything. And we're gonna relocate. Like my husband and kids are like on board, which is like scary in itself because like my kids had grown up in one place, right? Like
Yeah.
everything was gonna change. And I was like, it's fine. We had talked during the interview process about rad patterns. They were aware of it. They were fine with it. Or the woman who would have been my boss was fine with it. They offered me the job. I accepted. Like, we have this all in writing. I'm literally working with their relocation services people to schedule our move, to schedule a trip out there to go like house hunting, all of those things. We get around to January 2nd. I go to work. I put my notice in. I knew that what they were going to do because of the position I was taking at North Face and the product I was going to be working on, and the product and knowledge I had from Adidas, which was sports bras. I was going there to be tech dev for sports bras specifically, that they were not going to let me work my 2 weeks, which was exactly what happened. They were like, cool, today's your last day.
Yeah, oh my God. That sucks.
But like I was prepared for it.
But
It's
you were
fine.
expecting it, yeah.
Yeah. And I get home, and a couple of hours later, the North Face calls me and they're like, hey, so the like contract lawyers from VF, because like VF owns North Face and like all these other brands, they're gonna add to your contract and stipulate that you can't do anything other than like costumes for your company. And I have a couple of costume patterns, but that's not like the bulk of my business. And I was like, hold up, no, that's not a thing I'm agreeing to. And their reasoning was essentially, once I said no, they were like, okay, well, we'll go back. And then they came back again a couple days later and they were like, actually, now you can't have the company at all if you want to work for us. You have to sign away that legally you're going to dissolve this company and will not continue to have it.
Oh my God, what a tough like position to put you in.
And like, it's not like Rad makes $1 million or anything, but it makes some money. Like, that's part of our income. And I was like, first of all, you're asking me to take a huge income hit that I honestly can't afford. So you're going to need to pay me a lot more. But even then, even with the money, I don't think I'm willing to do this. I've built this thing. Yeah, it's my like pet side project, but I care so much about it.
It's yours. It's
It's
yours. It's the
mine.
thing that you made. Like, why is this big corporation going to come in and say you can't do that anymore?
And like the
And it was there
community.
before you started with them.
And like the community around it, that's the part that's really special to me, right? Like I know that you are part of that home sewing community, and like there's so many great things about that that I just like wasn't willing to give up. And we went back and forth for like a whole week talking about it. And eventually they just said, here's our reasoning. We can't guarantee that one single person might not see like a Vans t-shirt and decide I could make that myself and buy one of your patterns. So either sign this saying you're dissolving your business or your job offer is no longer your job offer. And like I talked over with my husband and I was like, having panic attack all the time. I was like, I don't know what to do. I don't want to sign this, but I don't want to like destroy everything for our family because then I have no job. I already quit my job. And he has been throughout our entire marriage, like a big proponent of me doing whatever is going to be the best thing for me, whatever I want to do, which
Oh,
like
to have that in a partner.
he's seriously the best. There was a brief time way back even in college where it's a long story, I won't get into the whole thing, but basically I almost changed my major and then I was sitting in classes doodling and he's just because a lot of other people in my life were like, no, don't go into apparel, that's stupid. Go be a doctor, go be a lawyer. Like it wasn't a thing that I was supposed to do. And I'm sitting in classes doodling, like sketching out clothes. And he just looks at me and he's like, no, this is what you want to do. Go do it.
Oh, I'm
Like
gonna
we'll
cry.
figure it out.
It's so
He's seriously the
beautiful.
best. And
To
so,
have somebody that supports you like that, it's invaluable.
It really
Or
is.
just
Like
for like,
I,
yeah, like what your life, like what it makes your life be. Yeah.
right. Yeah, I would not be doing anything that I'm doing without that support. And so it was the same thing. Like I'm being told that I have to either give up this brand that I have created that I care so much about, or give up this job and have no job. And he's like, it's not a question. Like clearly you don't want to give up your brand. Don't do it. We'll figure it
We'll
out.
figure
Like
it out.
you'll freelance. You wanted to do that eventually anyway. Do it now. So I turned down the job. I said, okay, bummer, but here we are.
That's amazing. And it
Yeah.
worked
And
out. It worked out.
it worked out. I had, like I said, I'd been freelancing a little bit on the side before. So I had those clients already. I used Upwork a lot. I think Upwork is a little more challenging now than it was 4 years ago because it through the pandemic, like it got flooded with freelancers. And now people with the economy where it is are like kind of pulling back on what they're hiring for. There's a lot more competition in terms of like just undercut costs. And like, I'm not going to work for an amount of money that I don't think is reasonable. I've done a lot of that, but I'm not anymore.
I
And
know when
so,
you're younger, and
right?
well, you had kids very early on in
Yes.
your like career path, but when you're younger, it's a lot easier to like just like do it, and when you're less experienced as well,
Yeah.
you're like, okay, well, I might not be making that much money, but I'm gaining a ton of experience. And if you're
Right.
smart, you apply that, which you did, like even starting Rad, like it gives you so many skills in terms of learning how to set up a business, learning how to pay your
Yeah.
taxes, learning how to,
Yeah.
find customers, or learning, just all these
Totally.
other secondary skills that you bring with you to every other aspect.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's a lot of, yeah, a lot of that business right off the bat was Upwork. And then I got way more than I expected. I got so many just direct referrals. As soon as the people in my kind of like networking community of like former coworkers or just people that I like knew in the industry in the area knew that I was freelancing full time, they were like, oh my gosh, you have to meet this person or you have to meet this.
Nice.
The amount of people that set up like coffee for me and someone I'd never met before that was like gonna maybe need a pattern maker, like was so invaluable. Like I could never thank those people enough for like
Oh,
how many
that's so
people they
amazing.
introduced me to. And like, yeah, I at this point a lot of my work is really referrals. I would say probably 75 to 80% is referrals, and the rest is I do still like I'm on Upwork still, so I get some jobs that way. But I did that all through the pandemic. So this was the end of 2019, beginning of 2020. And 3 months later, the whole world shuts down. And I'm like, oh shit, I have no job. And the whole world is shut down. And there was a couple of weeks that was like really scary. Like I'm sure it was for everybody. At that point, I'd already gone back to Adidas and done just like a 1 week project contract for Ivy Park. And I was supposed to be coming back for a second one. And they were like texting me like, hey, I know that you were going to come back for this. It's on hold because of the pandemic. All right. But then we had this like boom. I'm sure you probably experienced it too, of like once people realized it wasn't just going to be a couple of weeks and then everything goes back to normal, people started using that time to start brands or to follow their like passion projects. So I got a lot of work that way.
I'm trying to think of what I was doing at the time. I don't think I wasn't really freelancing. This is 2020. So I just started freelancing with like no like fashioning. Like I just finished
Yeah.
school and started, but I did get a couple jobs. So yeah. With
Yeah.
like zero experience behind me, I was able to like book a couple jobs. So I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah. And things went really well. And like, I just have anxiety in general. That's who I am as a person. But I always had freelancing this like little bit of anxiety of like, what if next month there's not enough work? And I think
Yes, let's talk about that. Like I said this on my podcast with Heidi. I was like, I don't think it ever goes away. Like I don't think
it
that
doesn't.
feeling of like, what if like I get no work next month? Like
Yeah. And
you just have to
it
learn to
doesn't.
live with it, or and
Yeah.
learn to just be like, okay, this is how I exist right now, and it's been working for X period of time, so it will probably keep working.
Yeah. And it's so funny that you say that because that anxiety, it's I'm a lot better at managing it now, but there was a point about 2 years ago where I was like working 90 hours a week sometimes because if people were offering me work, I didn't want to turn it
You're
down.
Like, I have to take it. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was just like overworking myself. It was not healthy. Like, just wasn't good. And I was like, I can't do this. And I thought to myself, maybe I need to like, maybe I do need the structure of like a job at a place and not freelancing for like my own not doing that to myself.
Sure. Yeah.
But I was trying to be like really, really think it through and really make sure, because I had the opportunity, which you don't always have, to make sure I was choosing to do that with a brand that was going to continue to allow me to not overwork myself. Because a big part of what became really toxic at Adidas and why I quit was overwork, except that was overwork as a salaried employee. So that sucked way more than overwork as a freelancer, where at least I was getting
Or at
paid
least
for
you're
it.
getting paid, yeah.
And I had been contracting off and on with a brand called Code Epoxy. They do outdoor stuff. And I had a friend there who I'd previously worked with at Adidas. She'd been there for a long time. And so when they started needing contract work for pattern, she hired me. And they were finally to the point where they were looking for an internal pattern maker. They had grown big enough. They were like looking for a pattern maker at the same time that I was kind of like, maybe I do want a real job again. Not that freelancing isn't a real job, but like a structured job for somebody else. And at that same time, a recruiter reached out to me from Nike for a 3D role. And I was like, I don't really want to go work for Nike, because I left a big corporation. I don't really want to go back to a big corporation.
Yeah,
But it wasn't like, it was specifically for 3D. And my husband's like, well, it's not going to hurt anything for you to do the interview. Like, you learn some stuff. If you don't want to do it, one interview isn't like agreeing to take a job that they might not even offer you.
Yeah.
But I go through the interview rounds for that Nike role. And at the same time I'm going through those rounds for the Nike role, I'm talking to my friend at Code Epoxy about how like, hey, I am thinking about taking a job, but I want to just be transparent about this. I'm interviewing for this role too. And at that point, the job at Code Epoxy hadn't actually been listed yet. And so I was like, I don't know what to do, because if they offer it to me, I don't want to like turn down an opportunity. I did start to get excited about that role because it was specifically 3D based. It wasn't within a business unit or like
And
product.
Nike, like they have just the budget they have and the like depth of experience they have and the teams they have. Yeah.
Yeah. And she was like, okay. So that like following Monday, Nike offers me the job and Code Epoxy also offers me a job.
Wild.
And I'm like, okay, I don't need to think about this. I'm taking the Code Epoxy job. Because
cool.
I'd worked with that team as a contractor and I'd seen them be like not a toxic environment.
Oh my God, that
seen...
makes so much difference. Like working with people, like I feel like that on Kristen Anderson's team right now, like working with people who you just love to interact with, it's makes like, again, like having a good partner, it just makes your life so much more meaningful.
And like one of the big things that had stood out to me, because like, right, Nike is Nike, but I don't know what I'm getting into, because I know a little bit of what I'm getting into, but like, you just don't know. And
you've been there, you've been there, right?
I haven't. Yeah, I've been there with
Adidas. I mean, in the corporate environment,
yeah,
like, you
yeah,
know,
yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And one of the big things that had stood out to me when I'd been contracting for Code Epoxy is we had been in a handover for a pattern project. And Corey, who I'd known from Adidas and who would eventually be my boss at Code Epoxy, like she's in this meeting and she had let me know like, hey, originally like our developer was going to be developing this, but her plate's full. She's at max capacity. So I'm going to be your contact for this. And something like that would never have happened at a big corporation. It would have just been like one more thing on that developer's plate and it wouldn't have been for her and it would have burned her out. So seeing a team interact in a way that was like so protective of each other and like of that environment, I was like, it's not even a question. The Nike job offer, to be very honest about it, was $30,000 more a year. And it wasn't worth that money to go
that's
and
such
get
nice.
Like a
corporation.
I went and I loved my role at Code Epoxy for the first 8 months. It was amazing. There were so many other little situations like that where everyone on the team had kind of come from these big toxic corporate backgrounds and was not going to let that be a thing on our team. I had had situations at places like Adidas where you'd have like merchandising come and be like, we need to add these styles. And development would be like, no, we don't have capacity. And you'd get told by your bosses that we weren't taking it on. They were protecting your workload. You weren't going to do it. And then 3 days later, they would come back after having hashed it out and be like, okay, we're doing it. And so you just lost 3 days of work and you were getting more piled on. Yeah. That didn't happen at Cotopaxi. Mm. Our merchandiser would come in and be like, hey, I want to add these. Like, do you have capacity? Just that like respect level of like, can we take this on? Or if you don't, can we look through what's in the line and see if there's room to take it on if we take something else out? Mm. That was like a regular thing that happened there. And I haven't experienced it anywhere else. And so I really felt like I was going to be on that team forever, for a really long time. And I really loved the work that I was doing. They hadn't had a pattern maker before me, so it was a whole pattern team. I came in to like fix fit. There were a lot of issues that had happened just from being like a startup and not.
You must have found that so rewarding. Like, it's so much fun to build a team with the skills that you have.
Yeah. I really, really loved it. And like I said, I loved every single member of my team there. Like, they were all great. I'm still friends with them, but things restructured a bit. There started being more like senior level management that hadn't been there before. Things started turning into a big corporation and not like a small brand that like has each other's backs, which isn't to say the people on the direct team didn't, because everyone continued to have each other's backs. We were all miserable together. Yeah. But we were miserable. And like, I don't want to talk bad about them because I love every single person on that team. And I know like they all worked so incredibly hard, but I started getting burnt out. I started seeing people I care about getting burnt out by this total culture change that happened. And I was like, okay, maybe it's just growing pains. Like, I'm going to stick it out. You know, sometimes that happens. You get like the team grew so much so fast. Maybe we just need to work out the bumps. And it just kept getting worse. And there just kept being more and more added to my plate. And at the same time that I was kind of being told, well, we're going to bring in additional people. And we did hire somebody else, a contractor for pattern right before I left. But it was one of those like kind of too little too late things. It was like, we're going to get enough help to make it me doing 150% of my workload capacity instead of 200% of my workload capacity. And it stopped being a culture where you can say no to things and started being a culture where, no, we have to figure out how to do it. And like, you can't make more hours exist in the day. Stopped having that work-life balance. That is why I took the job in the first place. And so I left. And I decided, you know, I learned my lesson from freelancing and like managing that anxiety. I didn't do it well, but going back and having a job that might not last being great forever, that the culture is going to change in ways that I can't control, isn't better. And so I left there at the beginning of September and I've jumped back into this freelance world. And like, I was honestly scared because I'd been out of it for like, I still took on a couple clients that I'd had long term from before I kept them. But I lost a lot of, you know, that kind of not necessarily credibility, but I think people just like seeing my name and knowing that I was doing this. People knew that, hey, I work at a brand now. I'm not taking on new freelance clients. I'd had people reach out to me when I first started at Cotopaxi, like, oh, so-and-so recommended you. And I was like, sorry, I like do this now. And so I just was like scared that I wasn't going to have that kind of amount of business to be sustainable. But I also wasn't sustainable to like work at a job that was making me miserable.
Yeah, for sure.
But I was also like, it's the first job I've ever left where I was sad to leave like so much about it. And it's been like 3.5 months and I'm still like kind of bummed, to be honest. But like things have gone so well. Things have built up so much faster than I thought they were going to. Like I was prepared to be like things to be a little tight for a while, like while I figure it out. But as soon as I started reaching out to former clients and being like, hey, I'm sure you've found somebody great in the, you know, year and a half that I haven't been working for you. But if you have anything, just heads up, I'm freelancing again full time. I would love to work with you again. And I had several of those clients be like, oh my gosh, great. Let's do this project. Or, yeah, I did find somebody, but can I connect you with this person? Because I know that they're looking for somebody. And so that word of mouth buildup for like clients has happened very quickly. And like, again, like I'm so grateful to these other people I know in the industry that are like, yeah, here, meet this person.
Yeah. That's how, like when I started freelancing as well, I reached out to, small home sewing pattern makers to help them do illustrations. And like, and it was, I wanted to do intimate apparel specifically. And so I was reaching out, like Emerald Erin was the first person I reached out to. And like, I worked with like all of them in like that first year, like a ton of them. Cause like they all, they all talk to each other. Right. So, and that's something that Heidi teaches on her course as well. It's like one of the main strategies, like reach out to your connections. Like when you don't have any connections at first, like that's harder to do. But when you do have connections, reach out to your connections and ask for referrals. Like when you do get jobs.
It's been, like I said, it's been amazing. I met up with somebody that I've known, who has like a consulting agency, now, and like, she's amazing. And, you know, she just started with this consulting agency and has just kind of gotten past that new beginning. Oh my gosh, this is scary, to like, oh my gosh, everything is, she has so much work and she, it's so well deserved. Like, she's amazing. And, you know, I just had a coffee with her and I was like, I just quit my job. Am I insane? Like, I don't have anything lined up, like not nothing, but like not enough lined up. And it's just, that world of connections. Like, we went to an event, like said hi to each other at the event. And she was like, oh my gosh, you should meet my friend. And like, so then I met her friend and her friend was like, oh, you would totally get along great with like this other person that's like, and like I've made all of these new connections just in the last couple of months that like I didn't have before. And some of those have led to work and some of those haven't and probably won't, but just as valuable in my
opinion. You never know.
You never know, but like they've led to having other industry people to like connect with and talk to, like just like this, like just
getting... I know, it's like we were saying at the beginning, like it's just so nice to talk to each other, like on like about the things that we like talking about. Cool. I loved this whole conversation that we had. It was so much fun. There's two more things that I want to talk about. Creating sports bras. So when we first connected, you had developed, you said you worked on the like sports bra development, and then you said you got hired by North Face to like, it was going to be to work on their sports bras. So I'm interested to know your thoughts on like intimate apparel, because this is like an intimate apparel podcast. So how do we make, how do we make clothes in 3D for sports bras? Because sports bras have a very distinct function, right? They have to be supportive and compressive. Like they have a big job to do. And 3D doesn't do, from my perspective, 3D doesn't do a great job of simulating that. So tell me about your experience in it.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't always do a great job. I think it's made a lot of like growth in that area, even just things like the soft body.
Just in the past option. Year, soft body avatars come out. Were you using it? Browseware has had soft body for a little bit longer. Were you using it with them at all?
No, we weren't. When we first started using Chloe and Browseware for sports bra stuff, it was usually to kind of do two things. One, we started to learn, when you look at the different fit maps that Chloe has, even though they're telling you this doesn't fit, we started to learn which colors really correlated to how things fit in real life. And we did that by kind of like experimenting with styles or bras that we knew fit well, because they were already fit approved, and like sewing those same things up in 3D and looking at like, okay, what does that fit map look like for this bra? And started to learn like, all right, that's kind of what I'm going after.
Right. Yeah. Chloe says that's too tight, but I know it works. So if I make it again and it says that part's too tight, then it's probably okay.
Exactly. And like a lot of the work that I do now as a freelancer in 3D, I'm downloading fabrics that are as close to what I'm going to use as I can find. And they're probably a pretty good sub. Sometimes I have, just because the actual fabrics I'm using happen to be brands that put their fabrics in the Clos market, like Closet marketplace and stuff.
Okay.
But
Do
at
you get them?
Adidas,
So Closet and VMOT are those are my two go-tos. Do you have any other
yeah,
places
those
for?
are my two go-tos. I use Substance fabrics sometimes. They've gotten better recently about their accuracy, but in like their property accuracy, but they're good for like certain visual textures, not as great for like fit. But at Adidas, we had like the actual fabric tool from both Clos and Browseware where you're scanning your actual fabric. So you're getting something
That's
accurate.
so
That,
cool. I want, like, I
yeah.
just want to play with that. Just like, can I just like go there for a week and play with your
Right.
fabric creator?
Yeah. And so like that in itself already kind of like put things ahead in terms of sports bras. But even then, we were really using 3D kind of like not as a whole team. I would use it myself if I was like unsure about a strap placement, or especially like with really strappy sports bras that have like an open back. Something that you'll run into, I'm sure you've run into this in intimate apparel, where like if you have a gap in the back, your strap is like a cross strap going this way, you start to get that like bubble or like it pulls in. So you have to like kind of overcompensate in your pattern shape, knowing that it's going to do that.
Yeah.
And so looking at that type of thing in Clos is something that I did a lot of.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Strap placement is huge, especially because like in real life, it's hard. Like even if you like want to like change the strap placement, it's like pretty tricky, right? Like you have to
Yeah.
like cut it and pin it and like,
Exactly.
yeah.
Yeah. So like I used it a lot for that. But then we also like I worked on fit for bra, like a huge bra relaunch that they did. The actual launch happened right after I left, but I had worked on that while I was still there. And so that a lot of those were like molded cup styles. So that's something that adds even more difficulty to really view in 3D. So we didn't always do a ton of 3D for those styles. It was a lot more physical fit, but we had one of the things that, again, like I got so much experience out of my job there that I like am so grateful for.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of research, a lot of data, a lot of things that we could pull from, a lot of wear testing, and just like the video capture, like motion capture, to show like breast movement. So things like that. This is probably something you know because you do, but in case listeners don't, like breast movement, especially in like with activity, like running, something like that, it happens in like a figure eight shape, which like people just think about like bounce up and down. That's not really how they move if you actually like put motion capture things all over somebody's breasts and have them like run on a treadmill. They actually bounce in like this figure
Like
eight.
on your body, like
Yeah,
that. Okay.
exactly.
Yeah.
And
No, I didn't
so,
know this, so that's
okay,
interesting.
cool.
So
Yeah.
you guys did that at Adidas. You were actually doing like tests where you would like measure the
So,
motion of the shape, like what was happening, the displacement of the breast.
we had a little bit that was done internally at Adidas, but most of it was done through a third party that we hired. And again, I'm like, I don't know what I'm allowed to say, not allowed to say. But there is this woman, Joanna Skerr, in out of Portsmouth University in the UK, who like her all of her research is on breast pain, breast health, et cetera. And
Oh,
so
cool. Joanna
they have,
Skerr.
yeah, it's like Schur, I think, but don't quote me on that being the
Okay,
right
I
spot.
can look her up.
But like she does all of this research into breast pain and breast health and all those things. And so we used her services so that we could have, they'll do wear testing where they're doing motion capture first, like braless, so that you get on that specific person, like what is their movement amount. And then we would have different bras, both our own that we were trying and then like competitors, et cetera, where they would do that same activity, the same model with that same motion capture to see like where are things, where is their bounce reduction, where is their movement reduction, and start to learn things about like how much reduction do you want? Because I think there's this idea with sports bras that like you just want to like hold everything down and then that's the best thing. But there's a point in movement reduction, and I don't honestly remember exactly what percentage it was off the top of my head, but I want to say it was like somewhere between 80 and 90%, where once you go past that amount of movement reduction, it actually becomes more painful again because like your skin is still moving, everything around is still moving, and so then it causes different but still painful issues. So
Interesting.
there's like a sweet spot in like how much movement reduction is comfortable for the wearer.
Yeah.
And like, so we like had all of the access to that to really then inform as we were making our own styles. You know, design got to use that information in terms of things like strap placement, coverage, like where do we explore different like reduction options or things that you could do in a bra. We did explorations in things like using different like bonding films in different areas to like apply different support, like how that might work. And then our samples could go and be tested at the same place so that we could get that data before moving
forward. Oh,
that's
so interesting.
It's like so cool. Yeah, so we did less 3D for bras, but like so much data, so much knowledge. Like,
yeah,
it was really cool.
And the thing that's cool about data is that like once it's in data format, like now it's ready, like it's primed to be used in other, like hope, like maybe used in 3D. Because like if you are now able to measure the amount of compression that this one particular style had on your bra, and then you can take that to a soft body avatar and then see like what, like if you can measure the, if once you get like measure, like I don't know, I'm just talking out of my ass here, but like once you once you are able to measure something, you are now able to apply it to a different like scenario.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I loved hearing that story.
Yeah.
Okay. We are so long on this podcast now. Thank you for all the time and all the stories that you've given me. This is that I loved everything. Very inspirational. Everything you've had to share. Okay. So I always conclude the podcast with what is your favorite part and your least favorite part of. Sometimes I ask, the end of this question differs for every person, but I feel like today, your story, like what has been like maybe the highlight of your career so far, your journey in design, and what has been like your least favorite part?
Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna go least favorite part first.
Okay.
I'm not gonna name the brand or the product, but I sat in a conference room in New York City a couple of years ago, surrounded by about 500 samples, of which maybe 30 proceeded and didn't get redesigned or dropped or changed in different ways. And that was kind of a moment of realization for me of like, this is not like part of what I love about 3D, especially is like reduction in environmental impact. So sitting there and being part of something where there were that many samples made for kind of no reason.
Yes.
I hated that. That was the moment I decided that when that contract term was up with that client, I was not working with them anymore because I didn't want to be part of that. And then the highlight.
You're like, we could have done all this in 3D. You're like, I could have done all this for you as 3D samples. Like, you're just not going to, you're just going to throw, because these go to the garbage after, right? Like samples that don't get taken or like changed for fit, they just go into the garbage. They're done. Like they have no life after that.
And one of the worst parts with some brands and some product, the product does get donated, which at least is like, it's not just going in the trash. With this particular brand and product, because of what it was, that wasn't an option and it all had to be incinerated. Like, that's not.
It's insane. It's
that.
Insane that that's like a business insane. Model that's viable at all.
Right. Yeah. And I just, it made me so upset. And so, okay, now that's why I was like, bad thing first.
Okay.
The best, the highlight of my career has been on the home sewing side, the community around Rad Patterns. Like I said, I started it at like what was really a low point for me. And I was like, cool, I'm going to try this. And if it fails, it fails, but I'm going to go in. The reason I named it Rad Patterns was because I want it to be this radical act of self-love that you can make things that make you feel good about yourself and that that's okay. And I've had people reach out to me and be like, hey, I just wanted to tell you that coming to this community that you've built, making this pattern that saw me regardless of my size, regardless like how I identify, it changed something in my life. Like I've had people say that to me and like, now I'm going to cry, but like
me too.
That has been like life changing for me. That's a big reason that why when it was choose your business or a job, Rad's going to live forever for me as long as I can keep it alive. Like that is the thing I want to bring to people, that like they feel good about themselves or like somebody saw them and cared about them as a person.
Yeah.
So that's been
my
highlight.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for coming on. Yeah. I cannot wait to edit this podcast and share it with the world. It was amazing. I loved it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It was so great to like connect. Like we said at the beginning, like just have someone else to talk about all the industry stuff with.
Yeah, totally. Okay, I'm going to stop recording now and we can have a proper goodbye.